And so my overall focus, both in my previous book, The Bush Agenda, and in the book, The Tyranny of Oil, is looking at corporations and their power, their influence, most importantly, their political influence, and looking at them as individual, you know, policy stakeholders. And in the last book, what I was looking at in particular was the influence of certain corporations on the Bush administration and its policymaking, and that was Halliburton, the Bethel Corporation, Lockheed Martin, and Chevron. And in doing that work, in looking at the policies of the Bush administration, looking at the Bush administration itself, and looking at the really extremely powerful social movements across the world, across the United States, focused on worker protections, consumer protections, consumer health, public health, addressing climate change, ending the war, and just a whole host of really progressive social movements that have been taking hold and in fact winning victories around the world. Why were so many of these agendas being stymied and particularly being stymied through U.S. government policy making? And that took me, probably not shockingly, to the doorstep of the oil industry and the oil corporations. And the way that this discussion is probably most useful to think of it in the framework of labor studies is the power of the companies vis-a-vis labor. Because my entire focus is that the power of the companies as a policy force, what their agenda is, the oil companies, and we can talk about auto as well, I'm sure that'll come up and it should, but actually, particularly quite recently, the interests of the oil industry and the auto industry have quite seriously diverged, and so it'll be interesting to talk about how those are different and have actually come head to head with the auto industry losing and the oil industry winning. So what I think of, how I frame this and how I think about this is the political influence that the oil industry is able to exercise and how that is so much greater and stronger than any other, has generally been, and in many cases is stronger than other constituencies. Those constituencies being labor, environment, human rights, environmental protection, etc. So I think, you know, it makes sense when you're looking particularly at the Bush administration. This administration is hopefully the apex in U.S. political history of the sort of hybrid between oil companies and a White House administration, and the sort of overlapping of those two groups. I think most people are familiar with the fact that President Bush had more experience running oil companies when he took office in 2000 than he had working for the government. He wasn't very good at it. He tended to run them into the ground, but nonetheless, this was his experience. The only other U.S. president to come out of the oil industry was Bush's father, George Bush Sr. Of course, Vice President Cheney had run Halliburton, the largest energy services company in the world, and Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State. I think somewhat well known that she had an oil tanker named after her, the Condoleezza. She was on the board of directors of Chevron for 10 years. She ran their policy committee, and she also had more experience with her directorship at Chevron than she had working for the government when she took office. But those three are just the tip of a much, much, much larger iceberg. And essentially what we saw with the Bush administration was the oil industry able to stop lobbying and really start legislating. They got key positions all throughout the administration and just fundamentally reoriented public policy from that position. And created a hybrid, and there actually is somewhat of a historical precedent. So the title of this book is Breaking Up Big Oil and Its Implications for Labor. Where that idea comes from is a historical period in time that is just so remarkably similar to where we are now, that it has only become more important that I began the book with this story. And what this story is about is the populist, the progressive, the revolutionary movements within the United States in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, which organized in response to, following the Civil War in the United States, companies were permitted to essentially merge, push out rivals, consolidate with free reign without any restrictions, and they did, and they used some pretty remarkable tactics for doing so. Let me just read some of the words describing Standard Oil's behavior, and this is words written by the Interstate Commerce Commission, the first regulatory commission in U.S. history. And it found Standard Oil's practices, and these are all quotes, unjust discrimination, intentional disregard of rights, unexcused, illegal, excessive, extraordinary, forbidden, so obvious and palpable a discrimination that no discussion of it is necessary, wholly indefensible, patent and provoking discrimination for which no rational excuse is suggested, obnoxious, absurd, inexcusable, gross disproportions and inequalities, and, quote, the most unjust and injurious discrimination this body has ever seen. Those were the methods used by Standard Oil to consolidate its power to become the largest oil company in the United States and in the world. Standard was the standard by which other companies followed their consolidation across the United States. And they grew into what the corporate model is referred to as a corporate trust, but really references to corporate trust in the United States became interchangeable with references to large corporations. Basically, it was large corporate bodies that were enabled to get so large that the concern was in the American public that they were controlling government, that they had gotten bigger than government and government couldn't control its actions. So let me describe, this is a cartoon, a newspaper cartoon from this period. Gives you a sense of what Americans were upset about. Okay, so this is a cartoon and it's a depiction of the United States Senate. Towering above the senators, three times their individual size, stand grossly obese men representing the corporate trust. Each man is dressed in top hat and tails. Standard Oil, the most dominant, is the only company depicted by name among the various other trusts. Above them is a sign, and it reads in huge letters, "This is a Senate of the monopolist, by the monopolist, for the monopolist." Off in the left corner is a teeny tiny sign that reads People's Entrance, below which is a bolted and barred door marked closed. So what people were upset about was that the companies had gotten so big that they were controlling government policy. And their response was a mass people's movement. There were thousands of strikes every year. Workers organized in unprecedented levels. The populist movement was born, the progressive movement was born, the organizing changed the position of the Democrats, it changed the position of the Republicans, they founded their own parties, and they succeeded in changing state laws and federal laws, and while some people sought revolution at this time, what they got was regulation. The very first U.S. government regulations on corporate activity, with such radical ideas as the 8-hour workday, the 40-hour work week, the right of unions to organize, the right of collective bargaining, the first campaign finance laws in the United States, and antitrust law. And it's been said that if Standard Oil, if Standard Oil Trust was called Standard Oil Corporation, we would have anti-corporation laws in the United States, but because it was the Standard Oil Trust, we have antitrust laws. The focus was laws to rein in industry. And the result was, again, through organizing, through strikes, through social movements, by 1911, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Standard Oil should be broken up into 34 separate corporate entities. The idea being that if it was smaller, its economic heft would not be so great that it could dictate government policy. Now, this was a very good idea. The problem, there's a lot of problems, I go through them in the book, but the biggest, which I would argue, is that all the social movements that had worked so hard to see these changes put into place and Standard Oil be broken up, once it was broken, they then said, okay, that's done, we'll go over here and work on something else now. And failed to do what a lot of us fail to do in social movements, which is to maintain that responsibility, which is to ensure that the government actually fulfills the job that you've given it the task to do, that it actually regulates, that it actually enforces laws. And left to its own device, government doesn't always do that, and generally requires us to remain vigilant. And essentially, I would argue that the American population didn't remain vigilant, and the government did not regulate the breakup. It did not enforce its own laws. But it took a while, and basically it took about 100 years. And over the course of that 100 years, some pretty important policy changes. The most important being the abandonment in the 1980s of antitrust policy and the adoption of this motto that held a lot of steam until about 3 weeks ago, the idea that corporations should be self-regulating, that we should allow them to regulate themselves, that the government didn't need to enforce regulation, that the government doesn't need to oversee, doesn't need to enforce, and that the corporations could be trusted to do all that themselves. And this idea really gained its force in the 1980s. And in the United States, the Reagan administration initiated taking a part of antitrust law and allowing companies once again to merge as they saw fit. And this began under Reagan, but it continued under Bush, it continued under Clinton, it continued under the next Bush. And beginning in 1990, there was a wave of mergers all across sectors, but in the oil and gas industry in particular, just since 1990, there have been 2,600 mergers just in the United States, just in the oil and gas industry, with the largest being the ones that I think most of us are most familiar with and are most important here, because these are the companies that have not only increased and consolidated their power within the United States, but have done so here in Canada as well. And those were the mergers that were permitted to take place of the two largest post-breakup pieces of Standard Oil, Exxon and Mobil, allowed to merge to form the largest, most profitable corporation in the history of the world. Based on revenue, Walmart did surpass Exxon in 2007 as the largest company. It is the world's largest employer. It has the highest revenues. However, if you compare profits, Walmart earned a mere $12 billion in profits in 2007, compared to ExxonMobil's $40 billion in profits. There's no comparison at all. Walmart looks like the little Arkansas podunk convenience store next to ExxonMobil, and it kept. So ExxonMobil was allowed to merge. Chevron had purchased Gulf Oil in the 1980s. It then purchased Texaco. It then purchased Unocal. Texaco had already purchased Getty Oil. Those companies are all Chevron. Conoco and Phillips were allowed to merge. BP purchased Amoco and Arco, two of the largest U.S. oil companies. Shell purchased a number of smaller post-breakup pieces of Standard Oil, and we allowed these companies to become behemoths. Now, one of the things I look at in the book is how that happened. Who were the policymakers? And I look at some key members of the U.S. government who were supposed to be the regulators in the Federal Trade Commission, were supposed to be the people looking at whether mergers should be allowed or not allowed. And it turned out that many of these individuals were people who were lawyers who were representing oil companies at a firm, who then went into the government for 1 year, 2 year, oversaw a merger, and then left and went to go work and represent those same oil companies at law firms. A tremendous, and I would say, fury trend that I document in the book. Essentially, who decided that these mergers should happen? Oil industry lawyers, in many cases, decided that the mergers should be allowed to happen. And I would argue, while they may not have broken any laws, and I don't argue that anyone broke any laws in the book, that there is maybe not a legal conflict, but certainly a moral conflict of who is supposed to be representing the public interest versus the corporate interest in regulatory decision making. But these mergers were allowed to take place. And the result of which was oil company bohemus, right? But the oil companies did not, they got a couple things that allowed them to grow in strength. One of the things they got in the U.S. market, which added to their financial heft and dominance, which affects their power globally, right, affects their influence here, but they were able to massively consolidate the U.S. refining sector and the U.S. marketing sector, gasoline stations. Why this is important, it's important for a number of reasons domestically in the United States, but why it's important here is essentially what they did was they had been previously making their money off of their foreign oil. So from about World War I to the mid-1970s, the oil companies owned the majority of the world's oil. They set the price for the world's oil. Then the oil countries nationalized the oil and took it back. And for a while, OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, owned the majority of the world's oil and set the price. That's now changed, and I'll get to why it's changed for a minute. But essentially what the oil companies were looking for in the 80s and the 90s was first more oil. And one of the ways that they did that was instead of exploring for oil, it was what they referred to at the time hunting for oil on Wall Street. They bought each other up and got each other's oil, and that was part of the idea of the mergers. Then they looked to turn sectors in the economy that had not been profit sectors for them, refining and selling of gasoline, into profit centers. And they did that in the same model that Standard Oil did. They bought up competitors, they pushed out rivals, they didn't build any new refineries, so there hasn't been a new refinery built in the United States since 1976. And they reduced supply of gasoline, and they bought up the gas stations. And while in the United States until very recently we produced cars faster than we produced babies, there were 50,000 fewer gasoline stations in the United States today than there were in the mid-80s because they bought up the gasoline stations and shut them down so they could control supply there, and so they could control supply the refining sector. Now, why that is important is that it increased their profitability and it increased their financial heft. But what they did that was probably the most important factor that affects all of us is that, so they looked around the world and they saw that most of the world's oil, well, all of the world's oil, is spoken for, right? There's only so much oil left. Governments own most of it. What isn't owned by governments is already owned by them or people who aren't, or other companies that aren't going likely to give it up to them. And so they needed to make the oil that they held, which is about 13% of the world's oil, more valuable. And they picked a pretty ingenious way of doing that. And what they did was the oil companies in the United States joined with the largest investment banks, and the surviving investment banks, by the way, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, joined with them and joined with Enron to lobby the U.S. government to deregulate crude oil futures trading. Now, this is going to make sense in a minute if it doesn't make sense now. Essentially, this deregulatory effort in 2000, happened in the year 2000. So first, sorry, let me back up one step. First, the oil and gas industry broke its own record in trying to get a president elected, spending more money than it had ever spent on trying to get Bush and Cheney into office in 2000. They succeeded. In the lame duck period before Bush and Cheney took office, they then went to the federal government to lobby it to deregulate a bunch of areas. Broad derivatives trading deregulation was one of the deregulatory changes. This is the subprime mortgage market, right? This is the financial crisis we just experienced. First, they deregulated a whole host of derivatives. Then they deregulated key energy trades. The first casualty was my home state of California. So Enron took this deregulation and used it to set up its own exchange called Enron Online on which to trade electricity. And because of this deregulation, this exchange was completely unregulated by the US government. So it took this exchange, it went to California, because we opened up our doors to them, and we said, take over our energy market, please. And what Enron did, and we now know, we have all the proof that they did this, was that they created a false scarcity of electricity in California. They moved electricity physically out of the state, they manipulated the market price, and they sent it skyrocketing. They reduced supply so drastically that we had rolling blackouts, so literally periods where there was no electricity in an entire city. I live in San Francisco, one of the largest cities in the world. We had periods of no electricity at all. That meant that businesses shut down, much suffering from the experience of not having any electricity, right? No cold water, no air conditioning, it was summer. No cool food. And our two public utilities went bankrupt, and the state lost billions of dollars, and Enron's profits skyrocketed, and people all across the state organized and protested and said, this is manipulation, they're manipulating the market. And we were told, oh, no, it's market fundamentals, supply and demand. And then we learned, and now we have quotes by the Enron energy traders where they literally say, it's the same stuff that the derivatives traders are saying right now. First of all, we knew it was illegal, we knew it was immoral, but we also knew that nobody was going to catch us because it was happening on a completely unregulated exchange. It was a playground. Nobody was watching. We were kids. We could play. And they did. Now, they got caught. And Enron, in many ways, imploded upon its own greed. But the Enron energy traders live on. And I don't mean this figuratively. I mean this literally. The same guys now work for Chevron, BP, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and they are doing with crude oil precisely what they did with electricity. Because in that same deregulation, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, remember, the two surviving investment banks in the United States, joined with BP, Shell, and Total to form their own crude oil exchange in Atlanta, completely unregulated by the US government, called the Intercontinental Exchange, ICE. ICE began in 2000, also happens to be the year when the price of oil began to rise. The 2006 is the moment when the price of oil skyrocketed. 2006 is also the precise moment when the number of trades on the unregulated ICE exceeded the number of trades on the regulated New York Mercantile Exchange. And that is now where the trading is taking place, and that's where the price was pushed up and up and up. Because we are in a unique moment in history, right? Between World War I and the mid-1970s, the oil companies owned the oil. They set the price for oil. Then OPEC owned the oil. It set the price for oil. Now, nobody owns the majority of the world's oil, right? OPEC only owns 40%. The companies only own 13%. The rest is owned by Russia, China, actors that don't act in concert. No group owns a majority. So who has filled that void to set price are now energy traders. And don't let anyone get away with calling them speculators. Because they are traders who are not just trying to turn a profit for themselves individually. They are traders who are working for the oil companies. They are working for banks. They are working for institutions that have an agenda. And they are working for themselves. And you get all of these guys into this mix. And we saw what I would argue is price manipulation. So the only other period in history where the price increased as dramatically as it did in between 2006 and 2008 was in the two 1970s oil crises. These were periods of intentional price manipulation by OPEC with a political agenda. The same price increase, I would argue, was due to manipulation, not for a political agenda, but for an economic agenda that had very real political consequences. So this made the price of oil go up, it made the profits of these companies then suddenly just unparalleled. And this is very important when we look at their political influence, when we look at their political bargaining position vis-a-vis labor or any other group. Because in 2003, ExxonMobil became the most profitable corporation in the history of the world, adjusted for inflation, period. It then topped those profits in 2004, topped them in 2005, topped them in 2006, topped them in 2007, and in just the first three quarters of 2008, they topped it again and earned almost more in just the first three quarters than they earned the entire year of last year. Chevron doubled its profits between the third quarter of last year and the third quarter of this year. It earned more in the first three quarters of this year than it earned the entire year last year. And those are just two of the companies. When you add up the profits of these companies, there is no comparison. There isn't. Defense, pharmaceuticals, I don't know, what are wealthy industries? High tech, the banks were the competitor, and not anymore. When you look at that money, and the reason why I'm concerned about profit is because of what they do with it, what they're able to do with it, how they're able to use that money, what they choose to use it for. So if you look at the financial, the amount of money available to other interested groups, there really is no comparison. If the defense industry can't compare, labor really can't compare. One of the numbers that I have in my head is, for example, the environmental community in the United States is one of the most well-funded nonprofit communities in the United States. The Sierra Club is the largest environmental organization in the United States. Sierra Club's entire budget for 2006 was $36 million, their entire budget, million with an N. ExxonMobil's profits for 2006 were almost $40 billion with B. So the political influence is simply unparalleled. Then you have how that political influence translates into regulation. So one of the biggest problems in the United States for workers involved in the oil industry is, I'm going to go back to this issue of the refining sector consolidation. So the reason why there hasn't been a new refinery built in the United States since 1976. In 1976, we passed the Clean Air Act in the United States. And it had two components. The first was all new refineries built in the United States needed to use not just the cleanest environmental standards, but the safest standards for their refineries, using the cleanest, safest available technology was the language. And all new refineries had to be built using this standard. But there was a catch. All existing refineries were grandfathered in. You could continue to use your existing refinery, dirty and unsafe, as long as you wanted to, unless you did something at the refinery to significantly, and this was not defined, increase pollution or output. If you did that, you'd have to retool the existing refinery to make it clean and safe. So what's happened in the United States? Not a single new refinery has been built since 1976. They're all using their existing old refineries, and these are old refineries, right? The one near me was built over 100 years ago, and they are arguing that they are not doing anything to increase pollution and not doing anything to increase output so that they do not have to retool them. So, we recently had in the United States the worst worker, the largest number of deaths of employees at an institution in the United States, let me just get this right, in the last 15 years. Um, The worst workplace incident in the nation in 15 years. 15 workers were killed and 180 were injured when a truck backfire accidentally ignited a flammable vapor cloud at BP's Texas City refinery. This was on March 23, 2005. The U.S. Chemical Safety Board, an independent federal agency, investigated the blast and released a devastating indictment of BP and Amoco, which owned the refinery before it merged with BP in 1989. The board faulted the companies, which were swimming in profits, for, quote, relentless cost-cutting, for refusing to upgrade the aging refinery, and for overproduction. The board also warned that such dangerous operations were not limited to the Texas City refinery or BP, but could be industry-wide. What we're seeing is massive cost cutting across the entire refinery sector. And near where I live in Richmond, California, we had a massive explosion at our refinery as well. It was in January. A massive vapor cloud of sulfur was released into the air. The communities received automated phone calls that told them to close their windows and shut their doors and not breathe the air until further notified. People were throwing up, kids were getting very, very sick, animals were dying. And we found out that the reason for the explosion was a 30-year-old pipe that Chevron had failed to replace and that had gotten old and had exploded. The other thing that these refinery explosions, and particularly this BP incident, revealed was that essentially no one is keeping track of workers that are working in, injured, or killed in U.S. refineries. The reason why is because more than half are contract workers, are non-unionized, are not employees of the refinery, and are hired to do the most dangerous work because they don't count as employees. And in the way that the Occupational and Safety Health Administration monitors employee health and safety at refineries, those workers don't exist. They're not being counted. And that was through intensive lobbying by the oil industry. And it essentially, the day before the BP explosion, there hadn't been any deaths at the BP refinery. And the day after the explosion, there hadn't been any deaths at the BP refinery, according to OSHA. Because those 15 employees who died, those 15 people who died, were not employees of BP. There have been massive lobbying efforts to try to redirect these policies. These policies that most people don't know about unless you're obviously directly impacted. And essentially, the weight and the heft of the industry has kept those obviously vital reforms from taking place. So the next thing then to look at is how this influences exercise and sort of what it means here. Obviously, the U.S. oil industry the Canadian oil industry has been dominated by U.S. firms for quite some time. But the latest push, of course, is into the tar sands region. And probably the most important thing to say there, and I could go on for quite a while about tar sands, and we can talk about it more. The most important thing, I think, to say is who these companies are that you're dealing with, because the way that U.S. companies have moved into the tar sands is by purchasing Canadian companies. That their initial entrance is to purchase Canadian companies. And then they've expanded out from their initial purchase point. And all the U.S. majors are in the tar sands, as are BP and Shell. BP was the latest entrant. It came in 2007. But the biggest players at this point are Imperial, which is ExxonMobil, right? You know that 70% Imperial, 70% of Imperial is owned by ExxonMobil. And Chevron. And that's why I keep harping on those two companies in my examples. These companies are massive now, their economic heft. So what they are saying in response to the economic turndown and how that will or will not impact their tar sand production is that the economic turndown is good for them. because the price of labor has gone down and the price of inputs has gone down. So steel and other inputs that they need in their production has fallen. That's good for them. And that means that their production will be able to continue because their inputs are cheaper. And these companies, and there's only a few of them, right? And the oil industry is one of the few, have so much excess cash that they have a massive cushion on which to continue their production. So Chevron recently introduced a $15.5 billion stock buyback program. You do that when you don't have any other need for the money. And what buying back your stock does is it removes a huge chunk of stock from public circulation, right? So it removes a layer of public control from your company. And the more stock you buy back from the public, the less the public has any sort of influence over your decision making, or whatever level of influence stockholders have. Some try and exercise quite a bit of influence. That is being reduced by the stock buybacks. Where the oil industry, these companies are deeply committed. I don't know, do you guys have the commercials here? Or at least the sort of propaganda attempt by the companies, as much as we have it in the United States, where they're trying to recast themselves as energy companies, right? That they're invested in clean energy. Have you seen Chevron's Siemens Energy commercials? So Chevron has a three-bar logo, and then interspersed in even intervals is wind, solar, hydrogen, geothermal, oil, to demonstrate their equal parts, all of these things. And BP has advertisements that show, you know, the sun and the wind and all lined up. Are these as much on display here?
Yeah, we can see them.
You see them. Okay. They are, I was just in Washington, D.C., and they are, I mean, I swear to God, you know, literally as big, three times the size of this wall, you see these advertisements because these companies are now deeply, deeply desirous of people believing that they're green energy. And I'm going to end by explaining why, to give you a sense of who you're up against. And then we can talk more specifics with your question. The first is, so companies are trying desperately to recast themselves as energy companies. I'm going to give you a big shock. It's going to be hard for a lot of you to take in, I think. But you can't believe their commercials. They're lying. It's amazing how difficult it is to find out how much they're lying. But let me give you one bit of advice if you're ever doing corporate research. That is to only ever believe tax returns and somewhat shareholder reports. Otherwise, anything else you read, don't believe. Press releases, websites, commercials, corporate responsibility reports, never believe corporate responsibility report, somewhat shareholder reports. But all the companies are required to reveal their tax filings with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. And those have to be available to the public. And most of the companies post them on their website. And that's where you want to get your information. It's boring, they're long, and it's tedious, but that's where the information is. So I read through all of the tax returns of all of the companies for several years. And what I found was that contrary to their claims, they are not investing at all in alternative energy. The very best among them was BP. And its investments in green alternative energy were 4% of their total expenditures. Now 4% is real money, especially when you're as big of a company as BP. But 4% does not qualify you to be beyond petroleum, right? The rest of the companies were 0% for ExxonMobil in 2006, 1%, 2%, basically they're not making these expenditures. They do intend to stay oil companies, and they intend to do it through tar sands production, although maybe not as much as they had previously anticipated before the downturn. Shale oil production in the United States, offshore drilling, and a belief that they can affect public policy such that policymakers will pursue the oil in the places where it is spoken for. So that is Iraq, Iran, the United States just opened up, and they may come knocking at your door for help soon, like they usually do, a new centralized military command structure for Africa called AFRICOM, based on a similar model we have for EURICOM and CENTCOM, the Middle East and Europe, the two places where we fought wars. So we now have one for AFRICOM and Africa, because we have increased our oil production significantly in Africa, and U.S. oil companies have increased their presence in Africa. And the Africans have not, on the whole, been completely welcoming. And so now we have an intense military focus on Africa. And the U.S. military has really expanded, I would argue, along sort of oil protective routes, and that they believe we will use our military to get their oil. Now, who are the companies and what are we up against? So speaking of Africa, Chevron is, so they intend to remain oil companies. They want us to think they want to be energy companies. Why do they want to do that? Okay. Two reasons. One, of course, they want you to keep buying their product. And they know that we're all concerned about climate change, among other things, so that if you fill up your tank with Chevron, you think you're making a clean energy investment, right? So you'll keep filling up your tank. The other is that they don't want us to implement government policy to do things like eliminate subsidies, increase royalties, reduce taxes, increase taxes on them, to take that money, to use it to invest in green energy, because why would the government need to do that if the companies are already doing it themselves? And of course the companies need all their money if they're going to be doing all this great green energy investing, so we can't take the money from them. The other is that they are all facing some pretty tough circumstances right now. So three cases against Chevron and then I'll stop. The first is Chevron is facing a mass human rights abuse lawsuit, an unprecedented lawsuit in the United States, where Nigerians who have been trying for 9 years to get a case heard in the United States against Chevron, and Chevron has been trying to keep the case in Nigeria. The Nigerians won, and this is unprecedented. A case being heard before a U.S. jury in San Francisco, where Nigerians are accusing Chevron of gross mass human rights abuses, including murder, in their production in Nigeria. This is a case that Chevron desperately wanted not to make it into the United States, and is now, literally right now, being heard in front of a jury. And they are desperate to have us think well of them while this trial is taking place. The other is a trial in Ecuador that is about to rule, we believe, in a $16 billion judgment against Chevron for Chevron's role after it acquired PepsiCo in the largest oil spill in world history across the Amazonian, the Ecuadorian Amazon. And the indigenous communities that live in that oil spill have sued. And PepsiCo before it, and then Chevron worked successfully to have that case moved out of New York, where it was first, into Ecuador, because the Ecuadorian jury is set to rule that Chevron owes $16 billion. Chevron's argument is that, oh, it's an Ecuadorian jury, we don't have to abide by that. It's very important for you here to understand. Their argument is that it is a foreign court, and therefore we don't have to abide by the ruling. They're going to rule that we owe them $16 billion. We're an American company, so what? Similarly, just along those lines, I hope you know that Mobil and Murphy Oil, and it's Exxon Mobil, but in the case they're referring themselves to Mobil. Mobil and Murphy Oil have sued a provincial Canadian government, and I think it's Alberta, through NAFTA. Alberta?
Yeah.
Because the Albertan government tried to say that the oil companies needed to invest R&D money directly into the province, and the oil companies are saying you can't do that because of NAFTA, and they're suing through NAFTA to stop that requirement from taking place. Then finally, the local community where I live, and this is important for the refinery developments that are happening now across Canada as well. To refine tar sand oil, tar sand production itself is not only more polluting, but refining the oil is also far more polluting. The reason why is that tar sand oil is thick. It's called heavy, dirty oil. Why it's called heavy and dirty is that it is more embedded with sulfur and other toxins. And those sulfur and toxins have to be broken off in the refining process to turn it into gasoline. And they don't break off and dissipate. They break off and disappear. They do break off and disappear. They are in your air. And right now, most of that refining is happening in Canada because the environmental standards are lower. What the companies want to do is move that refining into the United States And they're starting to do that, and communities within the United States are fighting back. And what, how they're fighting back is saying that we're going to simply set standards for our refineries that say that you cannot burn dirty or oil here. And if that succeeds in the United States, it would be a precedent that could be followed all over, which is simply saying we don't want a certain level of pollution in our community, and you just can't burn, you can't refine that here. So that's a lawsuit that's happening against Chevron in my community where I live in Richmond. So why should we break them up? I actually propose a bunch of different policy options on dealing with the oil industry. And the most important is just trying to rein in their political power so that other voices have an opportunity to be heard, whether that's labor or the environment or human rights or peace or any other set of agenda. And we know that that can happen because there was a huge shift in government policy making with the Obama election. A real repudiation of the battle cry of the Republicans in the election, which was drill, baby, drill. That was their rallying cry for the election, and Americans said that they didn't want that, among other things, and voted in the Obama administration instead. And what I argue is that we need to take a series of measures to reduce the political influence of this industry. And I think one, quite clearly, which makes sense to me, is breaking up the companies, primarily because I believe that the merger should never have been permitted in the first place, that it just stood against U.S. law to allow it. And then the ramifications globally have demonstrated that these companies have become too big to regulate, and that the pieces need to be broken off. But I don't think that that's enough, and I actually propose many, many other recommendations. But I've also been talking for a very long time, so I think I'll end it there, and we can discuss in questions those other recommendations, what I think about the Obama administration, more about the breakup, and any other questions that you might have for me. But let me just say one thing that I do propose that might be comfortable to end it off, is a call for the separation of oil and state. Essentially removing oil industry money from the government as much as possible and trying to balance things off in that way. So thank you all very, very much for being here and for listening to the discussion. I'm going to actually pass this around if folks want to take a look at it. And I'm ready for any questions.
Did you talk at all about